Good evening. A third of the votes are missing in Iowa, but Pete Buttigieg is apparently in the lead. Bernie Sanders close behind. What does the botched election mean? Yale's student body says it's time for the Ivy League school to forgive Puerto Rico. And activists in Albany call for police reform measures to pass. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with some of the news for Tuesday, February 4th, 2020. It was a shocking end to months of campaigning by the candidates seeking the Democratic presidential nomination in Iowa. The Hawkeye State has the nation's first caucus in what promises to be one of the pivotal elections in United States history. But even with today's announcement, based on 62% of the votes cast and nearly 24 hours after polls closed, the election is far from over. More than one-third of the votes cast, 38%, are missing, and little was said to explain where the votes went and how they got there. Troy Price is chair of the Iowa Democratic Party. He spoke a little after 5 p.m.
Good afternoon, and thank you all so much for taking a little time today. To chat a little bit about what happened last night. The reporting of the results and circumstances surrounding the 2020 Iowa Democratic Party caucuses were unacceptable. As chair of the party, I apologize deeply for this. Last night, we were faced with multiple reporting challenges and decided, out of an abundance of caution, to protect the integrity of the Iowa caucuses and their results by taking the necessary steps to review and confirm the data. A thorough, transparent, and independent examination of what occurred yesterday will follow. But let me be clear. My number one priority has been on ensuring the accuracy and integrity of the results. And we have been working all night to be in the best position to report results. And here, in just a couple of minutes, we will be reporting 62% of precincts from all 99 counties. The bottom line is that we hit a stumbling block on the back end of the reporting of the data. But the one thing I want you to know, we know this data is accurate. And we also have a paper trail and documentation that have been able to use to provide information to help verify the results. This is personal to me. I'm a lifelong Iowan. I have caucused for 20 years. And I know how important it is to our party, to our state, and to everyone, from our neighbors to new voters, to be able to come together all across this state. We want Iowans to be confident in the results and in the process, and we are going to take the time that we need to make sure that we do just that. So I know folks are going to want to be seeing the results as they come in, but I'm happy to take a couple of quick questions before that happens.
How can anyone trust you now?
We have been working day and night to make sure that these results are accurate. The one thing I will say is that the underlying data, the raw data, is secure. It was always secure. This was a coding error in one of the pieces on the back end, but the raw data, the data that has come in, is secure, and I can assure Iowans of that.
Troy, how can you verifiably demonstrate?
Do you worry it could cost you your first in the nation status or endanger the caucuses as a nation?
The fact is that this is a conversation that happens every 4 years. There's no doubt that that conversation will take place again. But right now, my focus is making sure that we get these results out. We are going to continue to do that, and we will have the results out as soon as we can.
Jeff. When do you believe you will get to 100%? When do you believe you will get to 100%? And how can you assure Americans that these are verifiably accurate results?
Well, we're going to take the time we need to get these results done. Now that we have the first batch that's going to be coming out here in a couple of minutes, we're going to continue to go through our processes, verifying everything. But the thing to remember here, folks, is that we have a paper trail. We have always said all along that throughout this process that we have backups to this system, that we have redundancies built in. And one of the ways that we do that is through the paper trail. Now, the fact is that as we started doing this last night, it took longer than we expected. And so, but my paramount concern is making sure that these results are accurate and reflect what happened last night in caucuses across the state. We're going to do just that, and that's we're going to take the time we need to do.
And when will that be? When will that 100% be, Troy? When will that be? When will that 100% be, Troy? Do you have an estimate for when that will be?
When was the app submitted for review by an independent third party? Why was the app never tested statewide? And why did the Iowa Democratic Party deny the Department of Homeland Security's offer to test the app?
We have, one, I have no knowledge of the Department of Homeland Security making that offer to us. I will say that we have worked with cybersecurity experts, nationally renowned cybersecurity experts, to test this app and to do testing and security checks on this app. So we took the steps we felt was necessary, but we found a coding error last night once we discovered some irregularities as the results started to come in. Yeah. What's that?
Were there any coding discrepancies during the third-party testing?
No, there weren't. And that's why, and that is why the, that's why what happened last night is simply unacceptable. And so, again, we're going to have a thorough and independent review of exactly what happened last night. We still, right now, we're in the process of making sure that we get these results out. And that's what we're going to stay focused on. Yeah.
Yeah. How do you combat that? How do you assure Americans that this is trustworthy, this data?
We have said all along that we were going to make these caucuses the most transparent possible. This year, we're reporting out more data than we ever have reported before. And in addition to that, we have paper trails that we've never had before. And so we're going to take the time we need to verify these results. But these results are being based off what happened in the precincts last night. When I ran for chair, I made a commitment to see the caucus process through. That is what I am working on. That is what I will continue to work on. And whatever happens after that is to be determined. Anyways, thank you all, folks. The results are coming in. We will see you later.
All right, so that's it. That's Troy Price.
And the results, as reported by CNN, have put Pete Buttigieg with 26.9% of the state delegates. Bernie Sanders close behind with 25.1%. Elizabeth Warren is in third place with 18.3%. And former Vice President Joe Biden coming in with 15.6%. Amy Klobuchar had a showing of 12.6%. All the other candidates were far behind. The Associated Press says that it's still too close to call, with 38% of the vote yet to be counted. In Iowa caucuses, attendees actually stand in corners of the room to express their first preference and then physically move to show their second preference before a final tally. The state has 41 delegates up for grabs during the caucuses. The Democratic Party in Iowa blamed a misuse of the app that was introduced this year to speed up the process. Rob Ritchie is with the voting watchdog Fair Vote. He says the errors were predictable.
Amateur hour, and that's but there's something sort of charming about that. There's also something that's kind of exciting to see people coming together, bonding, kind of positively expressing what they think about politics and sort of doing it in a communal way. On the other hand, right, they tried to professionalize it kind of in this halfway process. It's always been messy, but now they sort of tried to make it professional, and they just failed in that. And it was sort of a series of ways that it just was trying to layer on professionalism on something that's, you know, fundamentally still kind of an amateur production. When I was with people, they weren't aware that the results were going to be delayed. Things were problematic at the caucus, but I think there was generally a good spirit. I was at two different caucuses, each of which had, you know, more than 650, 700 people. It's a long night, but it is kind of fun for those who are seeing their candidates do well and see other people joining with them in that. And then, of course, you're waiting to see what happened. And then there's sort of this growing agitation that their results aren't there. I think the media does have a certain kind of obsession over that part of it. But I think, you know, the party made a huge mistake by not creating reasonable expectations. And reasonable expectations were that it was going to be very hard to do some of these new processes, and they couldn't just sort of run in the ordinary schedule. So I think that, you know, the whole drama of what's happened and that did well and so on. Obviously, there's sort of a certain way that we usually find that out, and that's all been kind of punctured by this. The presidential candidates did about 1,000 events in Iowa over the last year, spent tons of money. And what does that all mean when, at the end of the day, people are still going to try to understand the results and will they even focus on the results when they finally come out?
Do you hold any credibility for the theories that have been coming out? Some conspiracy theory against Bernie Sanders because he was winning.
I actually don't at all. I think that this is a trying to follow new requirements from the Democratic National Committee, which wanted to Iowa to professionalize, trying to make it a more democratic process, having individual votes counted and recorded. You're trying to do things that weren't really part of the caucus history, coming up with systems. It's still, at the end of the day, it's not a professional election. We're going to find out, though, very soon.
Did you get a feel for who was winning?
And I think that people, on the ground, certainly where I was, the two strongest candidates were Sanders and Warren. And I think there's a sense that that's going to be true across the state, at least for Sanders. And I think that he will almost certainly win an individual vote. We'll have to see. But I think those numbers will come out. I don't believe that the fact that we didn't instantly find out results won't change the dynamics that this is still going to matter. And, you know, I think that, let's say it was a conspiracy theory, it wasn't a very good conspiracy because it's not going to hide the fact that the results are going to come out.
Doesn't it help Trump? The newspapers are saying this gives an opening to Trump.
We'll see. This is a long process, and I think we will find out the results. People are going to focus on them. Iowa is going to have challenges keeping its position going forward, but I also think that we will be moving forward. And I think that at the end of the day, this isn't as big a deal as maybe people think it is. But here's what I hope is true, that it leads to substantial changes that make the Democratic nomination process, and I would like to see the Republicans as well, fairer and better. And I think that there's a series of things that we're starting to see that would make that work. And, you know, Iowa shouldn't always go first. We should diversify who gets that opportunity. I think the fascinating part of the Iowa thing where people's second choices matter is a doorway in that we should all step through to go to ranked choice voting in these elections, where you can really not have to worry about split votes and vote for whom you want and still get a good backup if that's what you need. So there's a direction for reform. In some ways, what happened in Iowa may ultimately be the instigator for some needed improvements.
And ranked choice voting is a system where you can actually vote for rank your preference of numerous candidates, and that could affect first, second, third round voting, et cetera.
Right. It's starting to win around the country. Actually, going to be used in New York City in 2021. It's used in Maine, going to be used for Maine presidential elections this year, more than 20 cities. And it's one that several presidential primaries this spring are going to use ranked ballots. And Iowa did it kind of in this quasi inefficient way where they were asking people physically to move toward second preferences if their first choice couldn't be, quote, viable for winning delegates. Much more simple way to do it, and one that would have been quicker and faster and better would have been just to have people use a ranked choice ballot, say who your first choice is and second choice and so on.
I see. So you use a complicated way. You think they're going to lose their position as first in the nation 4 years from now?
Well, I think it's likely. I think that was probable anyway. I think that there's recognition that other states should have a chance to be at the head of the line. And
Rob Ritchie is with the voting watchdog Fair Vote. The first actual primary is in New Hampshire on next Tuesday. And the news is developing. BuzzFeed has put Sanders ahead of Buttigieg. Sanders has 24.5%, Buttigieg 21.4% of the vote, and that, they say, is with 65% counted. We're going to keep with this story as these lost votes are discovered around the state of Iowa, and we get the numbers turned over to WBAI. And it was a busy day in international news. The coronavirus outbreak claimed its first life in Hong Kong on Tuesday. It was the second death from the new coronavirus outside mainland China and brought the toll from the fast-spreading outbreak to 427. Thousands of medical workers in Hong Kong held a second day of strikes to press for complete closure of borders with the mainland after three checkpoints were left open. Total infections in mainland China rose to 20,438 and nearly 200 cases have been reported across roughly two dozen countries, Hong Kong and Macau. Meanwhile, in New York, One patient is being treated at Bellevue Medical Center and had a fever, cough, and runny nose, according to the city's health commissioner. Two others are being treated at hospitals in Flushing, Queens. All three had recently been in China. And the European Union rejected parts of U.S. President Donald Trump's peace plan for the Middle East on Tuesday, prompting an angry response from Israel, which has strongly backed the United States' proposal. A statement from EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell, who said Trump's plan departs from internationally agreed parameters. Steps by Israel to annex Palestinian territory, if implemented, could not pass unchallenged, Borrell said. And the U.S. Defense Department said on Tuesday the Navy had fielded a low-yield submarine-launched nuclear ballistic missile warhead. The Pentagon believes the new weapon is needed to deter adversaries, but critics say it lowers the threshold for using nuclear weapons. Low-yield nuclear weapons are equal to the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, about 20,000 tons of high explosives. The Federation of American Scientists said last week that the Navy was scheduled to deploy the low-yield warhead on the USS Tennessee in the Atlantic Ocean. And this report from Moscow, Russian priests should refrain from the practice of blessing nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction that can inflict indiscriminate loss of life. That's according to new guidelines being discussed by the Russian Orthodox Church. Russian priests have long appeared in images sprinkling holy water on submarines, ballistic missiles, Soyuz space rockets, and other pieces of hardware as part of rituals to bless them. The document on the Moscow Patriarch's website said blessing or sanctifying weapons that can kill an indefinite number of people must be excluded from pastoral practice. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. The Domestic Animal Welfare Committee of the New York State Senate voted to pass new laws today prohibiting pet stores from selling dogs, cats, and rabbits, instead encouraging the stores to showcase rescue and shelter animals. The bill proposed by New York State Senate Deputy Leader Michael Gennaris has 17 Senate co-sponsors. Gennaris had this to say.
Important step in the process of ultimately passing this legislation and stopping the puppy mill pipeline here in New York. One of the issues that we face is that many of the puppy mills that are unscrupulous and result in unhealthy dogs and bad treatment for the animals in these mills happen out of the state. For some reason, a lot in the Midwest, from what I understand. And we are now trying to become another state in the list of states that has moved to cut off the demand for animals from these mills by prohibiting the sale of not just dogs but also cats and rabbits at retail establishments. The problem with the sales that occur are many. Many times these animals have health problems that are not known to the person who purchases the animal, and then they have to spend thousands and thousands of dollars in health care costs that they had no idea was going to be the case, in addition to the cruelty to the animals themselves who are raised in these mills. Some of the awful stories you hear and the terrible violations that occur involve summary execution of female dogs when they are no longer able to breed, in some cases by literally being shot in the head with a firearm. The unsanitary conditions in which the ways in which these animals are kept is cruel and inhumane. And so I'm glad that the committee moved the bill today and look forward to its passage on the floor later this session before the full Senate.
And that's New York State Senate Deputy Leader Michael Gennaris. There are about 80 pet stores registered throughout the state that would be affected by the potential law, according to the New York State Department of Agriculture and Markets, which regulates pet dealers. The American Kennel Club opposes banning stores from selling purebred dogs, saying it would put both dog breeders and retailers out of business. And Communities United for Police Reform and other groups from the Safer New York Act Coalition gathered in Albany today, calling on, or they'll be gathering on Albany, in Albany tomorrow, calling on legislators and Governor Cuomo to pass the Safer New York Act, a package that includes a bill to repeal 50A. That's a bill that provides for secrecy for police officers who don't want to release information about past disciplinary problems they've had. Another bill strengthening the governor's special prosecutor executive order and marijuana legalization with a racial justice framework. Michael Zasitsky is lead policy counsel at the New York Civil Liberties Union. He says groups opposed to the Safer New York Act have been spreading misinformation, and the groups are going there. His group is going there to set the record straight.
Albany will be renewing our push to pass the Safer New York Act, which is a package of bills designed to improve transparency and accountability in police practices across New York State. So the groups will be up in Albany tomorrow advocating for these bills because New York is really falling behind when it comes to issues of police transparency and accountability. New York is one of just two states that makes records of police misconduct completely secret and not available to the public, even in cases of severe misuses of force and police brutality. So one of the things that we're advocating for as part of this package is legislation to repeal the section of state law 50A that prevents the public from knowing whether police officers actually face any kind of discipline when they engage in serious misconduct. The package also speaks to the fact that there's no data collected uniformly statewide on just how many low-level so-called violation-level offenses are enforced by police agencies throughout the state. So the Police Stat Act, which is part of the Safer New York Act, would require uniform data collection, including demographic information on how many people actually have these encounters with police statewide so that we can get a sense of the full impact of policing on the lives of New Yorkers. And the package also includes a measure that would codify Governor Cuomo's executive order appointing the attorney general to act as special prosecutor in cases where people are killed in a police encounter. This was a major win back in 2015 to have this executive order in place, but we want to make that a permanent law and expand on it to make sure that this option is available, not just during the term of any one governor, but that we have an independent investigator and prosecutor going forward to ensure that there's a real measure of accountability.
And that's Michael Zasitsky, the lead policy counsel at the New York Civil Liberties Union. Another bill introduced in the Senate is known as the Blue Lives Matter bill that would make violence targeting first responders a hate crime. Civil rights groups oppose the bill as weakening hate crimes legislation aimed at protecting traditionally oppressed groups like gays, lesbians, immigrants, and people of color, among others. They say the bill promotes fear-mongering. And finally, last Thanksgiving, hundreds of climate activists stormed the field during the Harvard-Yale football game, one of the most widely watched in the nation. About 50 people were arrested. Many were not initially protesters, but took the field in support of the environmental protesters who had planned and initiated the demonstration. Now the Yale student government has stepped in, voting to ask the Yale administration to divest its holdings in fossil fuels companies. They also called for forgiving the $70 billion in Puerto Rican debt held by Yale. Nora Heafy is with the Yale Endowment Justice Coalition.
The Yale College Council, which is the Yale undergraduate student body, they have representatives from all over the Yale College, voted unanimously at their Senate meeting last week to join the Endowment Justice Coalition formally. The Endowment Justice Coalition is a movement of many, many different groups of students, alumni, faculty, and New Haven community organizers who have been organizing for the past 2 years around the demands that Yale cancel its holdings in Puerto Rico's debt and divest from the fossil fuel industry, culminating last November in the action at the Harvard-Yale game.
Puerto Rico's debt to Yale, tell us, what does that entail?
The Puerto Rican debt is pretty complicated. It's about, numbers vary, but it's roughly $70 billion of debt. And it's not money that Yale actually lent to Puerto Rico at any point, but rather the banks or funds that did lend the money then sort of package up that debt and sell it to other hedge funds. And it just gets passed around because it's been declared unpayable by the Puerto Rican government. It's deeply exploitative and has accrued huge interest rates. So it's a very high risk, high reward investment. Yale has fund managers that they hire to manage a chunk of the endowment. And some of Yale's largest and most influential fund managers have huge holdings in the Puerto Rican debt. They have bought this repackaged debt. And in a couple cases, they were actually suing Puerto Rico to be repaid first, effectively to make profit for Yale and for Harvard and a couple of their other clients before any recovery or rebuilding from the hurricanes could happen in Puerto Rico.
What's the Yale administration's response to this?
They haven't given any kind of formal response yet. And in fact, they are pretty unresponsive in general and unwilling to enable any kind of meeting between students and the people with decision-making power over this. They've just refused to meet. But unlike an activist movement, the Yale College Council has all kinds of built-in administrative channels. They will be meeting with the Yale Corporation, which is the Board of Trustees, in a couple months. One of the most significant things to come out of this vote is that it not only signals that a very institutional and like the formal representatives of the undergraduate student body are unanimously in favor of this, but also they have the ability to open doors to put these demands forward to the administration in a way that we have never had access to before.
Just go back to the football protest. What was, just briefly, what was that about and why'd you do it?
That was a joint action between Yale Endowment Justice and Fossil Fuel Divest Harvard. And we had come together over the course of a couple months, and we knew, you know, we knew that the game was a really critical moment for both of our campaigns. It was a time when millions of people around the world would be watching, including lots of alumni who don't know that their universities fund our education through these like horrifying investments.
Was anybody arrested?
Yeah, 50 people from Harvard and Yale students, alumni, community members were arrested. What was really notable was that we had a group of about 150 people from both universities who knew that this was happening ahead of time, who had been prepared and trained and, you know, were prepared to risk arrest. But once we got out there, hundreds of other people just from the audience who hadn't known that it was going to happen ahead of time just spontaneously decided to join and ran onto the field, you know, chanting, divest Yale, divest Harvard, cancel the debt. That was a moment when I felt like we had a shot at winning.
Nora Heafy is with the Yale Endowment Justice Coalition. And just one final update. BuzzFeed reports with 65.5% of the vote counted in Iowa. Bernie Sanders at 26.25% and Pete Buttigieg at 25.15%. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, February 4th, 2020. The news is produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.